Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
All right, Maddie, episode number 2. It feels like we were just recording this yesterday. I don't know. I don't know why I feel that way, but this is coming quick. So excited to share this interview that we had. But let's talk quickly. What predictions for the Super Bowl? Topics surrounding the Super Bowl? It's our last week at NFL football. We got to make sure we enjoy it.
Absolutely. So, you know, this is going to air after that Super Bowl already happens, but we'll make our predictions now. I'm taking the Cincinnati Bengals, not necessarily because I think they're the team that's going to win. I'm just a believer in Joe Burrow. I like everything that he's about. But when you talk about who wins Super Bowls, it's usually the team that can get pressure with a defensive line that doesn't have to blitz all the time. So that would say LA Rams. I'm not an LA Rams fan. I'm not a fan of the all-star team that they put.
You're an underdog? Is that what you're saying? You're an underdog?
I just like the story of Joe Burrow from not getting recruited to going to Ohio State, wasn't going to play there, transfers, goes to LSU, has one of the greatest seasons, actually the greatest season any quarterback's ever had, and then takes a franchise that was in shambles in just his second season, brings them all the way to the Super Bowl. I love that story, and I'm all about it.
You know what's great about the recent quarterbacks that have all are either at the top of the game or just retired? Ben Roethlisberger, I'm obviously going to point to him first. Miami of Ohio, not highly recruited. Aaron Rodgers, community college. Tom Brady, like fifth, sixth round draft pick. Burrow, and I'd say like some of these overcoming adversity stories are overplayed a little bit, but these are not like five-star recruits coming out of high school. For the most part, there are guys that have battled some kind of a climbed a hill and got to where they want through hard work.
So you're not going with Stafford because he was the number one quarterback since day one.
Yeah, but then he's with the Detroit Lions for how many years? So yeah, I'm going with the Bengals because I want AFC North to win. Some NFL fans would be the exact opposite of that. I love Burrow, but I wouldn't mind seeing Matt Stafford come away with the championship. And I'm not going to hold the LA Odell Beckham Jr. and like all these hot shots like against him. I think he's always been very tough. Like there's clips of him. What was it? Separating his shoulder and still playing in a big game and driving him down the field with 2 minutes left. I forget what it is, but he's a tough guy. A lot of respect for him. But all these guys, like Philip Rivers, recently retired, point to him, like not highly recruited, NC State grad. Like yeah, a lot of players, and you could point to what's that?
He won zero Super Bowls. He's like Dan Marino, my favorite player all time, never won anything.
Stud, though.
Stud.
We're not talking championships. We're talking some of the best of all time.
Well, when we get to our interview with John Grant Jr., we're going to be talking championship standard because that's what that guy brings.
Yeah, well, I would agree with that. That was a phenomenal interview. Well, you made a point about something Joe Burrow said in his press conference, and it's been like the media snippets have been out there on Twitter and Instagram and stuff. Tell us about that.
So Burrow, in an interview, when talking about social media, and which most guys – typically do, which I did see that Von Miller got on social media, but it was last week, real quick. And then he said he was going to turn it off, but a lot of guys turn it off. And then when they asked Joe Burrow his advice for young athletes, the big quote that I saw was he said, "Work hard in silence. Don't put it all on social media." And I'm like a little torn about this quote because everything we're telling these high school guys to get recruited, and him being a guy who did grind and worked hard, but didn't get recruited, right? We're telling these young athletes, these high school guys, you have to have your highlight video. You have to post it on Instagram. You have to post it on Twitter. If you have it, like show these college coaches that you're working and that you're working hard and consistently improving. So he goes out there and he kind of says the opposite. Like just do the work in silence, which I don't know. I don't know about that message. I, I'm I'm definitely conflicted on it, and I'm trying to think if that's the right message. I mean, I'm all about it. I'm all about character and what you're doing when nobody's looking. But these college coaches that are trying to find the next athlete, like, they want to know what you're doing all the time.
Yeah, there's a balance to everything, and I would say it's easy to shout down from the top of a mountain and say, like, this is what you should do. And it worked for Joe Burrow, but he's obviously a special talent. I think you got to decide who you are, and you got to stick to that. So if you're a guy that's so okay and comfortable putting this stuff out there on social media and you feel fine doing it, then do it. If you want to pursue schools heavily, then do it. I think it goes back to stop worrying about whether or not the push of the social media is going to help you or hurt you or whatever. I think it's deciding what you're comfortable with and then just committing to it and not worrying about what other people think about that. And you'll look back and have an opinion. Hindsight's 2020, but you know, you got to have your highlight film on YouTube. You have to send it out to coaches, but to post that you had a workout or to continually remind people that you're working hard, like, if you're good enough, coaches are going to know that. So I don't want people to just completely be in the dark of, like, I haven't done anything social media wise. I haven't put a film together. I don't promote myself at all. I don't think that's good, because we're in a day and age where you have to do a little bit of that. But when guys get over the top with it, I think that can be somewhat of a red flag too. It's like they're self-involved. There's ego involved with this. But I think it's a case-by-case basis, which is what makes it tough from an evaluation standpoint on the coach's side. Like, I don't think John Grant Jr. is going to do that if he's coming up now. Like, you tell me. You know him better as a friend, but like, he doesn't seem like the kind of guy that's going to do that. He's just going to say, I put the ball in the net. If you want that on your roster, then I'm here, right?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think one of the things that's special about him is that he didn't win a championship until later on. I think he was about 29 years old or 30 years old before he won his first championship. And then once he learned how to do that, they just came rolling in, right? Title after title. And I think, you know, you change as a person, you change as a player, and realizing that maybe, you know, the best thing for you, and when you're done with caring and worrying about the stats and just worrying about being the best teammate possible and helping build a culture, I think that becomes a lot more important. And some guys see that, and some guys don't. So I think it's a case by case basis. But one of the things I learned from Junior was how to act like a champion and how to be selfless and be a great teammate. And you know, but there's some guys out there that want to use their social media platform to post all the time that they're working out, or maybe now that they're not. Like, I would love to have thought about if Deion Sanders had Twitter or Instagram when he was a player, because you see that 30 for 30 about primetime, and he was going out and partying in Miami the Tuesday before the Super Bowl, and then cracking jokes at Jerry Rice saying, hey man, it's just Tuesday. The game's on Sunday. Like, it's not a big deal. Whereas you have guys that are not going to be doing that kind of thing. So I think it's case by case, but you know, I think you have to find maybe the right balance between the two, and maybe just posting the progress that you have made as an athlete, like showing that, you know, let's say bench press, that you were able to up the weights that you had there. You don't have to show every single time that you do a workout to improve some of those numbers that you have in bench and squat, but just show your personal best. And maybe that's the balance in finding what makes the most sense for college coaches and trying to impress them with your social media.
Yeah, I would say, like a lot of things, less is more. I think having a presence is a positive thing. I think going over the top is a negative thing. And to your point, you got to find balance. But letting people know where you are is a good thing. Switching gears, I think it's be prudent of us to talk about some of the things that we got into in this interview with Junior in terms of and I lied. I said we were going to steer away from Hopkins. Here we are, episode two, talking about Hopkins. And to address another thing that Terry Foy kind of called us out on was having people on that didn't necessarily have a platform. I was always super intrigued when Junior got into the college coaching world of, like, similar when Casey Powell did. Those are two very different people, but like, I was kind of like, what's prompting this? Kind of what's the motivation? What's his ambition? I think it's very clear that he's in it for the long haul, but I was curious about that. So I was curious about John Grant Jr. as a coach and not necessarily a player. And I think this interview provides a lot of clarity on that, but going back to what I was talking about before, what is the perception of Hopkins? What has been the perception of Hopkins for guys in our generation versus what's the perception of Hopkins for guys in this next generation, and how are they addressing that challenge? So for me, I went to the Hopkins. I saw you play in a Final Four when I was in junior college at Howard. I watched the 100th anniversary game of Hopkins Maryland at Homewood, snuck into that game through the Hall of Fame that was adjacent to the field for my whole high school team. And that was like one of the best memories I have in the sport. We sat up there and watched that game. It was incredible. But Hopkins was like the end all be all for me. And I'm sure for you, like, you're an alum, you won a national championship. The perception now is that this is a team that has everything that they need to be successful, but they aren't a year after year Final Four team right now. And they're battling against Big Ten and ACC universities that have a ton of resources, that are pouring these resources into the lacrosse programs because they have those. And it's just a different battle that they have. I said this in the interview with him. I'll say it again. I believe in this coaching staff. I think these guys are not consumed by all this distraction and noise, but as outsiders, to talk about it is exciting, and to kind of figure out how our recruits looking at Johns Hopkins as an opportunity. Educationally, it's like incredible, right? It's right there next to the Ivies. But can you unpack that a little bit more than even I did?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was there for only 2 years transferring in. But I fell in love with Hopkins. They weren't even playing. It was 1998. I was at the World Games watching Team USA play on that field and just absolutely loved everything about Homewood. When I transferred in, what I learned was that there was just an amazing amount of tradition, that the school was behind you, and that the guys just worked extremely hard to try to win championships. And that was always the intent and the goal. I think this new staff has challenges just outside of just stepping in and being coaches at a program that maybe hasn't been to a Final Four since 2015. There's been new athletic directors the past 7 years. There's been changes in the school and trying to find more balance and being more academic. And then there was COVID, right? And I think we're the only staff that completely changed during COVID, and everyone dealt with challenges there and every school dealt with it. But with the Hopkins Hospital being at the forefront of what's going on, and you'll hear about that a little bit more in the interview, these guys didn't even get to meet their team. They've been dealing with a ton. And I don't think there's another program whose alumni have higher expectations for the team. Me personally, I understand.
You tell me, Matt, it's national championship or bust this year, right?
I mean, I don't think that's my mindset. I want to see.
I hope not.
I want to win championships. Like, that's why I went there. I wanted an opportunity to win a championship, and I got to play in two title games. And I still think I remember talking about it with some of my roommates in 08 when we lost to Syracuse. That was kind of the passing of the torch in my mind. We were both tied with 9 national titles. Syracuse beats us. Now they got their 10th, and then they turned around the next year and won another one. And I thought that was kind of the changing of the guard there a little bit, and being just disappointed in myself that I let the program down in the future there. So there's high expectations always. I'm excited for this coaching staff. I got to play with Jamison Kesterer. I've seen him as a coach do great things defensively and a very innovative coach. John Grant Jr., I consider the greatest professional lacrosse player of all time and a guy that just knows how to win. Right. Excited for Coach Milliman coming in, had great teams at Cornell. Who knows what would have happened? I think they were the number two team in the country undefeated when their season ended in that what was that 2020 when everyone's season ended. So I like the pieces here. So I'm excited. I just want these guys to show growth. And more importantly, I want the players to have the experiences that I got to have when I was there. Right. I felt special walking on that campus during the springtime. I loved that I went to a school with a higher education. And I just, the band playing during games, the smells from the sausage stand, the alumni throwing bananas to who they thought were the game MVPs on the field from the stands. There's just so much tradition around the program that makes me so proud to be a part of it. All I want is the current players to feel that too. And they haven't had that opportunity yet. And I hope that they do get that this year. And I hope that that's what continues. And I think this coaching staff has the ability to make that happen.
Yeah. That's great, man. That was the plug that I was waiting for. And I just got it. The emotions start to pour out of you. And it's a beautiful thing. As you know, I spent 6 years with Greg Raymond, and he was a three-time captain at Hopkins. He was a red shirt his sophomore year, I think, and then continued on. I think they won one or two, maybe one his senior year.
He was there in 05.
When Benson Irwin and Harrison, and I think Benson Irwin did the Dirty Bird,
the OT game winner against Virginia in the semifinals. Oh my God.
These young bucks have to go back and watch those tapes. I mean, Tillman Johnson and just like that was such a good game. It's such a good tournament run. But one of the greatest teams of all time. My point in saying that is he says it to our Hobart team, or has said it to our Hobart. Expectations are meaningless. He always said it. And as I move forward in life as an individual on any team that I'm on, like they really are. Your expectations don't mean anything. They're noise, it's distraction. Your execution, your investment into what you're doing, your passion for your teammates, like that's the stuff that matters. And that's where you learn that at Hopkins. And you know, huge influence, Dave Petromala, on him, on you, and in turn on me. You know, some of those same principles are going to continue to live on in the Hopkins program. And I agree. I think that this I would call it youth. I don't know if that's an appropriate word, but new energizing of the program is going to be interesting to see play out. I mean, you have to give them time, especially under the circumstances. So I hope everybody enjoys this interview. Matt, I promise you from this point forward, we will steer clear of Hopkins at least a little bit. But it is an interesting topic right now, so we're going to touch on it. But enjoy this interview with John Grant Jr.
All right, Matt Bockley here with Pete Pouillon. Very excited to be interviewing John Grant Jr., current offensive coordinator at Johns Hopkins University. All right, I'm going to do my best right now to try to name all the different accolades that John has collected over the course of his career. What I love so much about Junior and being able to play with him is that he does not care about all the MVPs and the stats that I couldn't even name if I tried to. All he cares about is those championship trophies and those rings. So I'm going to do my best right now to name those off for Junior the player. So I have right now a World Games championship, 3 World Indoor Game titles, 5 Major League Lacrosse titles, 1 NLL lacrosse title, and 5 Man Cups. Junior, was I even close for you as a player? Does that sound pretty good?
Yeah, you got them. There's like a Heritage Cup and some like riff-raffy ones in there. But
what's the Heritage Cup?
That was just U.S.-Canada box. So I'm 1-1. U.S. beat us in Canada one year.
How did that happen?
We had like an all-star team, and they had like an actual team, and they ran us into the ground. It was like me and like Gary and Paul Gate and like Tavares trying to play defense, and the U.S. team was basically like that 01 Wings team that ended up beating the Rock,
yeah,
which was heavy American, like Hanford and Schiller. And it was basically Berge. It was that team. So we were down like 12-1 or something. We came back, we ended up losing. So we got him back in the States a couple years later. But
Schiller's like semi-Canadian. I feel like us Americans kind of, we put a Canadian tag on him. I don't know why. Maybe it's the Rochester in him, but.
Well, he did marry a Canadian girl, so that helps.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish in 2010 he would have played for us and not the U.S. I might have been able to add another world field title to my arsenal. He was a big pickup. All right.
Well, I'm going to try to continue here real quick with John Grant Jr., the coach, in some of those championship accolades as well. I have him as the two-time Colorado High School State Championship head coach at Valor. I also have him as the World Championship assistant coach for Canada in 2014. I have him down for a MLL championship as the assistant coach of the Denver Outlaws, which you can't see, but he's proudly rocking that Outlaws hoodie. And I also, do I have him for anything else? Nope, not for titles, but for those that don't know, before Johns Hopkins, Jr. was the offensive coordinator at Air Force before making that switch over to the Johns Hopkins University.
Yeah, we did actually share conference championship at Air Force my first year. We lost in the playoffs.
If we're going to start counting conference championships and all your other accolades, we could be here for the next 45 minutes.
Yeah, that's not
trying to name that off.
Get this though. I got the Great Western Lacrosse League. I got a ring for sharing a three-way tie for the conference championship. I still got an Ohio State ring, and I look at it and I'm like, I don't know what this is supposed to mean to me, but it's a ring. So
yeah. I have a 2005 Great West championship ring because obviously Fairfield University in Fairfield, Connecticut, won that conference in 2005, beating Denver University in the championship
game. I think your other ring in college is probably a little better. Yes,
I'll take the other ring.
Hopefully I can.
And that's what we're here to talk
Let's
about.
Go. That's the one I want to talk about most.
So we, in our first episode, Matt and I introduced ourselves as guys that are trying to provide a platform to people and voices that aren't heard from much. I'm not sure you meet that criteria as a player, but and we talked about this, but I think everybody, myself included, is interested to hear from John Grant Jr., the coach, and just your transition into coaching and kind of what you guys are doing at Hopkins and moving forward. So without rambling on too much, I'm gonna turn it over to Matt for this first question.
So just a quick history of Johns Hopkins University in about 135 seasons of lacrosse. All right, Johns Hopkins has won 44 national championships and has played in 70 plus Final Fours, hundreds of All-Americans most people know about the program, right? The history, the tradition is just incredible. But in the last, let's call it a decade, right? We have not been to the Final Four in 7 years since 2015 and have not won a championship since 2008. All right. So you go and you look at the history of the program, and we were averaging about one championship every 3 years since we started in the 1800s. But that hasn't been the case as of late. So my question for you is, in taking this job about a year and a half ago, what was kind of your perception of the Johns Hopkins lacrosse program that you were entering into?
Well, I mean, I've known about it my whole life. One of the great former Blue Jays, Dave Huntley, was a family friend. So I talked to him at length about it. Him and my dad were buddies. They played on Team Canada together. And whenever I was in Maryland, I would sit down for a meal with Mr. Huntley and talk lacrosse. So I've always known about the Blue Jays and about Hopkins. Obviously, as a poor student, that wasn't a school on my radar, but I know, I mean, I'm in love with lacrosse, the love with the history. So I like to call myself a kind of a student of the game. And to be quite honest, did I ever think I would have an opportunity or even the thought of doing college coaching wasn't really anything on my mind. I've coached my whole life. I coached when I was 13. I coached a Tyke House League box team. Me and Trace Kolesky, there wasn't enough coaches. So we were coaching five-year-olds in box. And I've kind of caught the bug. I've coached my whole life. My dad was a coach. He's coached for 50 years, 60 years. So it's in the family. The game is in the family. And, you know, as you know, Bach, living in Colorado, I thought that was it. I got, you know, cut my teeth in high school lacrosse and then got the opportunity to coach Division I at Air Force. Was I ready? Not really sure, but I took that challenge on. And, you know, as things have it, you know, college coaches change and the carousel began and I found myself here and I knew it was going to be the challenge of a lifetime, but that's kind of who I am. I want the hardest job possible. I want to turn things around and I want to bring this program back to where it belongs at the top.
Yeah. So I think taking that a step further, I think, you know, we will draw parallels from a playing standpoint to a coaching standpoint. And I don't think correct me if I'm wrong, but from a playing standpoint, I doubt that you'd ever be able to imagine that you'd accomplish what you have. I don't think anybody could. Now you are at Hopkins because I watched the Air Force film. Like I saw some pretty creative things you guys were doing on offense and you had success at the high school level. You've won at every level. So like that's not necessarily in question. I think you've earned what you've gotten in every step of the way. I think what I'm interested in hearing about is like the perception of Hopkins that we grew up seeing those guys win the national championship and go to Final Fours. I think now when you go to recruit these 15, 16 year olds, they haven't seen that from Hopkins as much. And now describe the challenge of re-energizing this program along with Coach Millman, who I'm a huge fan of. And I think he did great things at Cornell. And I'm looking forward to seeing your guys' development at Hopkins. But what's that challenge? How do you view that as a whole from a recruiting standpoint, from an execution standpoint with your current team? Like, and that's a lot, but what goes through your mind when you think about that?
Well, after convincing my wife to let me go for the job, I didn't question my drive to help return this program to where it belongs at the top. And I've experienced similar circumstances in my life, whether playing or coaching, you know, in Peterborough, not unlike the Hopkins of college across Peterborough, lacrosse is like that in Canada. And they went through some lean years and I was a part of it and we could never win. And it was 30 years before we won a Manna Cup. So I was part of kind of that and certain other places, you know, even like helping the Outlaws 1 year with Bach, finally getting the champ. Like, so being a part of a program and a program's ascension is very important. And there's a lot that goes into that. Experiences plays a major role in it, whether you're a coach, player, equipment manager, you know, winning is winning. And there's a lot that goes into it. And I knew this was going to be an uphill battle. And I wanted the challenge. I embraced it. We got a long way to go, but fortunately it's the season and we get to take these giant steps week after week. And I think there's a lot riding on it for us professionally. There's a lot riding on it for these kids. They are Hopkins guys. Bachley can speak to the pressure that these guys live under. And you know, I try to help them with that as much as possible because I understand what people expect of them. And sometimes it's, you know, it's a perception and they need to get to a level that they may not ever get to because they're constantly chasing what's been done. And, you know, they hear it every day. Well, why are you not winning? This program wins, like Bacchus says, every 3 years. That's a lot for a young man to take on. And the X's and O's aside and the relationships build with the players, but that this is where I feel I can really help them is like, I understand what it's like to not be able to win. I went my whole career early, first decade of my career, and I couldn't win. I was the guy that, you know, was really good, but couldn't win a title. And I know what that feels like. I've been under that like dark, dark cloud, and it's hard. And that's the kind of stuff that I think I can help these guys through. And you know, we're early yet, but I'm hoping that's the goal at the end, is to help bring these guys back and use my experience and in that world to try to help them get that little edge here and there. Cause it's tough, and Bachler can talk about it. I mean, it's not easy to play under the immense pressure that Hopkins has. I mean, there's a few schools in the nation are like it, but you know, we're right there, because you're right, we haven't won in a while, and it's time to get back there.
And just real quick before Pete follows up with his next question, you had talked about Dave Huntley. I have a great story playing with his son, Kevin, at Hopkins, and Dave went on and he played there and won multiple championships and was a phenomenal player. All of us seniors were out to dinner in the middle of our senior season, and all the parents were there, and we were getting ready for our NCAA tournament run that we were about to embark on. And Coach Huntley stood up and he was giving a speech, and for those that don't know him, he was, you know, very timely with his comic relief. And one of the things he said while giving this great speech from not just a parent, but an alum, was that he wanted to thank us seniors, because that season we had lost 3 games in a row. And his freshman year, he was on a team that didn't win a championship at Hopkins. He wanted to thank us for those 3 losses in a row, because we weren't the worst team in Hopkins history. He wasn't a part of the worst team in Hopkins history anymore. And we were coming off winning a national championship in 2008, and he's cracking jokes what alumni are thinking about when it comes to the Hopkins lacrosse. And then one last thing I wanted to mention that you brought up, you talked about everyone when they think of the Denver Outlaws and the MLL, just a great franchise that won multiple championships. And what they don't realize is that we started in 2006 and we won 8 seasons of being the best team and in the regular season, but not being able to find that way to get over that championship hump and learn how to win a championship. And we traded for you in 2014, because that was something, like you had mentioned, you learned how to do win a championship later in your career, but something that you became very good at. And you came in 2014 and you definitely showed us in the locker room and what to do on the field and how to act like a champion all the time. And then we went on to win a championship your first season on the Outlaws in 2014. And then again, when you were with the program in 2018 as a coach, still being
good,
that
good skip. Thank you. I appreciate
it. Don't worry, I'm not going to bring up 2016. So don't worry.
Yeah, my computer would suddenly just die.
2016, where we played against you in that championship game. But we'll save that chatter for another time, and I'll kick it over to Pete now for our next round of questions.
Well, I was just gonna say, like, I think it's harder for an 18 to 22 year old to process that, the expectations. But for you and for Coach Millman and Coach Kester, it's easy to say expectations are meaningless. But I think half the battle, just being in the coach's locker room, is like making sure that your emotions or your stress about meeting those expectations doesn't pour onto those guys. And I don't think that is ever going to be a question for your coaching staff specifically. I just don't see anybody on the staff that really is going to deal with any stress that they haven't dealt with previously. So I think that's a great thing. And like I said, I'm a huge, huge fan of Coach Millman and what he did at Cornell, and just his approach to coaching the game as a whole. So we're rooting for you. This is a question that I think Matt, myself, and now you not have to deal with, because that's way overstated. But what would you say to somebody that says, just because you're a good player, or in your case, a phenomenal player, doesn't make you a good coach? And what do you feel like makes you a good coach? And the third part to that question is, what do you feel like you're working on as a coach?
Well, the people that say that are generally right. I mean, and I I would say I got away with a lot as a coach early in my career in high school, you know, the club scene and some other things, based on just, I think I tricked a lot of people based on what I did as a player. But I've been learning, and I continue to learn, and I'm extremely lucky to have the coaching staff that I'm with now, that I've learned, like, yeah, every day I go to work, I can't wait to get there. And it's not even just the time with the guys and coaching, it's like learning and being a better coach. I mean, funny story, my first year coaching at Valor, I'm running a play, and one of my seniors goes, and Bach will know him, the Ryan Russell. I'm like, well, what is wrong with you? He goes, Coach, they're running a zone. I'm like, oh. Okay. I don't know what to do here. I think I had a zone against me in 1998. I don't remember doing anything other than just dodging still. So like, you know, and I'm you know, pretty self-deprecating with it. Like, I didn't know a lot, but I was able to really relate with the kids and the relationships I was building with them. We almost won a championship that year. And I'd be honest to say, like, I didn't really know what I was. We didn't coach them up on a 10-man ride. We didn't really coach them up on a zone. My assistant was John Glenn, who's now the assistant at DU. So we've both come a long way, but learning to be humble about it, learning to get better, and learning from other people that know more than I do. So I've been very lucky. I had like a phenomenal group of coaches at Valor that coached me. You know, George Wozdecki was a DU hockey coach for the Lightning. Learning from him, my AD was an ex-NFL player. So like taking the professional development was huge for me to learn how to coach. Knowing the game and knowing how to coach the game are two different things. And I've dealt with it as a player and having these guys coach me. And I'm like, you have no idea what you're doing. And now the shoe's on the other foot. But I don't pretend I know everything. I don't act like I know everything. I try to learn as much from my guys as I do teach them. And I'm just trying to sponge it all in. And I think I know enough to be dangerous and I've continued to get better. But I know people say, to be long-winded here, like, just because you know how to play doesn't mean you know how to coach. That's true. And you got to learn. Just like to be a great player, you got to practice and you got to get better and you got to keep learning from other people that have done it. I take time out of every one of my days to learn something from another coach online, because I don't think you can ever be a perfect player and you can't be a perfect coach, but I'm sure darn going to try.
I imagine that's what you'd say, but the way you describe it is perfect. And the word humble is thrown around like constantly and misused constantly. Like, people win a championship. Oh, this is humbling. Oh, this is humble. That's a humble approach to coaching. And I'm like, I appreciate it as somebody that has every reason to be overconfident or arrogant or whatever, pick the word. The fact that you approach the game that way, even still as a player, let alone a coach, is awesome. And I'm sure your players appreciate that very much.
Oh, I hope so. I think relationship building is the first for me. In my style, that like gaining that trust and showing that vulnerability to them gives them the opportunity, I think, to give more without. I know there's been a couple times, and even one of the young Hopkins guys last year said this comment that stuck out to me because I used it in my previous life as a player. I was coaching a lefty up and there was a lot of pressure under this young man, and he finally blurted out, he goes, "I can't do what you did." And I didn't realize that that's how it was coming across. I just thought I was trying to help him. And it literally hit me like a ton of bricks. I remember Paul Gate coaching me. And I literally said the same thing. I'm like, I can't do what you do. I'm not 6'4", 220. And I don't have a twin running around helping. So like, but it was kind of funny how like that jogs your memory. Like,
yeah.
But if I don't have those relationships with them, then I don't get that feedback. And ultimately you don't learn. So I think it was refreshing for these guys to understand that, A, there's a relationship to be had here, and there's an honest feedback both ways. And if they feel something on the field, that I give them the green light to do that, because that's how I wanted to be coached. Well, as Bocklet knows, I didn't really accept coaching all that well until I was older. But fortunately, there was a staff in Denver that coached me 12 years before, so they kind of knew me already. But
I was going to say, I'm remembering summer 2015 where we had the ball against Rochester in overtime in the Broncos stadium, and we drew up some kind of play. And that play ended up being Junior getting the ball behind the goal, dodging for 30 yards behind the goal, getting to 5-5, drawing a double team, and then shooting a around the world through a double team right over John Galloway's shoulder for the O-team winner. Still probably the greatest individual play I've ever seen. And I'm pretty sure that's not how it was drawn up in the huddle prior to that, coming out of that timeout. But also great to hear like the approach of, you know, realizing that sometimes, you know, well, for you especially, you're never going to coach a kid that's going to be able to do the things that you were able to do as a player. And if you do find that that kid. Hopefully he's in a Blue Jay uniform.
Well, we'll look for him. Trust me.
Yeah.
I know where to look. I know where to look, but it's not something I will coach them to do because it's not really.
You see Trevor Zegras's goal where he flipped it over the net and
that
was that you're around the world question mark. What, I don't know how to describe that over.
I should have passed to one of the two Bachlets that were open, but anyways, they were the first two to give me a big hug. So they were okay with that. Still have that Grateful Dead jersey sitting around here somewhere.
That's the best uniform I think ever made. I still have mine as well.
Yeah.
Kind of switching gears a little bit. You come in, Coach Milliman, who comes over from Cornell, brings you in to be the offensive coordinator. He also brings in Jameson Kesterer, who I played with on our 07 Hopkins championship team, who I believe was coming from UMBC, where he had coached them up to have one of the better defenses in NCAA lacrosse. And prior to that, I believe he was at Ohio State. So all guys that had done extremely well as individuals, now having to come together and coach as a group for the first time. And they show up to Hopkins, and I didn't even really know this until you guys came out last week for the scrimmage against Denver, and I was able to sit down with you guys. You weren't able to have a fall ball in your first season. You didn't get to meet the team until January of 2021, so rolling right into a quick spring season, which we saw the team get better over the course of that first season. Now you have your first fall ball, but still with some limitations and like not being able to be in the locker room as a team. Kind of talk about the challenges of being on a staff where guys have never really coached together, and also being around a team where like you just had your first ability to be in the locker room. Like there's just so many things that people didn't know about that situation when you guys first got there, and then dealing with or trying to learn from each other as a group and coming up with what you're trying to do with your team when you didn't even get to really meet them or get to know them until you were already playing games.
Yeah, and I know it was tough and challenging for everyone in the world, not just lacrosse coaches, but for us specifically. I mean, you know, we were hired during the pandemic. I was hired over Zoom. I was in Colorado. Coach Milliman was in Ithaca. Coach Kesterer was already here because UMBC. The volunteer was in Amherst. And as you know, a former roommate of yours, John Cohen, our director of ops, was also in Colorado. So we were literally coaching this squad from like four states at the beginning, and we weren't really allowed to come to the office. So I got hired in May. I think I moved to Maryland in September. We weren't allowed in the offices, so we were kind of sneaking in and out of there. We weren't allowed to be in each other's offices, so we kind of were like doing like in-office Zooms. So we weren't able to really put some chemistry together, so for me personally, the hardest part for me to get, you know, on top of this is A, you know, it was a giant kind of step up from where I was. Running a new system. I don't quite run exactly what I ran basically everywhere else I've coached. Coach Milliman and I have kind of morphed together in offense. I was foolish if I wasn't going to run what he ran at Cornell. I mean, they were the top scoring team like a couple years in a row. But yeah, trying to learn his system and put my spin on it and try to get an understanding what Coach K does and practice plan, like we weren't able to do that till January. And then for the first 2 weeks, we only could do 10, coach 10 guys at a time. So we were going 6 hours a day because we had like 60 plus kids. And then all of a sudden we got shut down after the second week for 10 days because of another outbreak. So we took 10 days off, then had like a week to prepare for Ohio State. And for me, like I said, it was challenging because I didn't know these kids and they didn't know me. And now here I'm barking orders and trying to install a brand new offense that I just learned myself and trying to nuance that. You saw the result. It wasn't pretty. But, you know, for us, and I know Coach Milliman and Coach Kester are all completely different in certain ways, but we're all, you know, very close to the guys to understand what they need and how to coach them best. And you can't really coach a kid all the same way. They all need to be coached differently. You need to push different buttons. You need to back off with some, and you need to push harder with others. And you don't learn that on the fly. And we tried to, and I think as we started to, you know, put it together and more restrictions were lifted. I mean, we had our first team meal during the Big Ten tournament. That was the first time we had a meal together. And I remember the first practice was, I think, the Penn State, so the quarterfinal game. We were told we didn't have to wear masks on the field. So I remember it was a beautiful day, and Coach Millman brought everyone in, and everyone like yanked the mask off their helmet. Coaches, we all like threw them up in the air like it was a graduation party. But I mean, not understanding, like, holy crap, we didn't even have a team meeting. Like and I know other programs had some similar issues, but it was very difficult for us to figure it out. But once we were able to kind of get on the road and get outdoors and start having some meetings, that's when we started forging some bonds and building a culture, because culture is ultimately everything. You can have everyone has good players, but it's the culture you build and the buy-in you get from your team. And you can't do that over Zoom. As you guys all know, we've lived in the Zoom world the last 2 years. I mean, Bach, we were trying to Zoom, get ready for the bubble tournament, and like, we couldn't get anyone to talk. We had to have Uncle Tony tell them to loosen up. Like it was, and trying to get any kind of anything from these guys that didn't know us and didn't trust us. They just had, their, father figures basically ripped from their lives. And now all of a sudden I got to open up to new people. And for me, I know it was tough for a couple of them, because they're like, oh, this guy, and now I got to probably learn to play like he played. And is he going to try to teach me behind the backs and all this stuff? It was hard, but that's in the past now. And we've had a full fall and a month to get ready, and we're right in the middle of the season. And in 2 nights we got Towson, and 2 more days after that we got Georgetown. So let's go.
Yeah, that's awesome. I just listening to you talk, being at Marquette and dealing with some of the same stuff, but it's different at being at Hopkins, where you're at like one of the most highly regarded institutions from a medical standpoint that there are. And the fact that you guys were brand new at that time, it was tough for everybody, but uniquely difficult for you guys. And you guys are still in the infancy of this thing, it sounds like. And but from a relationship development standpoint, it sounds like your staff is very aligned. And it also sounds like all three of you have a kind of a high emotional intelligence, which I think goes a long way for a group that is in a situation that you guys are in at Hopkins, where there are expectations. They haven't won to the level that they're quote unquote supposed to. And so, again, I go back to the fact that there probably aren't three guys tailor-made for the job better than you three, and I look forward to seeing your progress there.
Not to cut you off, our volunteer assistant, Dan Anino from Amherst, he's a bright, bright young man. I take time out every day to learn from him as well. He was, doing great things in Amherst, and you add him to the mix too. High level player, played at Amherst, played in the championship game, coached in a championship game. Coach K obviously won one as player, is, getting there as a coach. Coach Millman was a very highly skilled player in college that was played national championships, also played professionally. So we've got a staff, and even our director of ops is literally orchestrated with Mr. Bachlett there, the greatest professional field lacrosse team that ever played. So even we've got guys.
John Cohen is a great evaluator of talent. I talked with him about high school players in Colorado, and I was always like pretty impressed with his. Well, maybe it was right. We were either both right or we were both wrong, because we both agreed.
He's never wrong. If you've met him at all.
Yeah.
I also appreciate, I promised myself I wasn't going to be the first person to bring up his name. So I appreciate that you guys both brought him up first, because I don't want to give John too much credit. But yeah, he put together some incredible locker rooms for the Denver Outlaws, which, he knows just as well as the rest of the staff, that culture is just as important. What's happening off the field is just as important what's happening on the field.
I don't know where we're at from a timing standpoint. We got 2 more questions for you though, so we're going to move forward here. I think the next question is your vision for your playing career, whether you had one or you didn't. I'm sure you had some goals that you set for yourself. From an ambition standpoint as a coach, you get into the Division I landscape, I guess later, because your playing career went so long, and here you are. Like, have you thought about what your goals are personally as a Division I college coach, and things you want to accomplish?
Yeah, I said it earlier. I want to get better. I've got so much room for growth as a coach. And I've got the right people around me to do that. They push me to get better. And if I'm slacking in one area, they make sure that I do and do quickly. That's my main focus is that, because that in effect will help the players that I have currently and will help the program get back to where it is. And my head is around getting better, getting my players better, and winning games. And that's it. Yeah. And preparing these young men for greatness off the field after college, whether it's in pros or in the business world, or, you know, we got a pre-med guy, like wherever they go, we want to make sure these guys are rock stars when they get done, and using lacrosse to do that. And obviously we got coaches on that. You guys are with me on this. That's the greatest part of our job is to do that. And I'm just tackling that challenge, and it's hard, but you know, anything worth doing is, and I'm going to keep going here. I've got a lot of things to do here at this program, and, you know, settling into the Baltimore area and raising my young daughter here in the game of lacrosse. And you know, she's went to the first game, and I finally got to hear the band play, and, you know, saw them throw the banana at our face-off guy, and all of the stories and all the lore I've heard, we, you know, gotten a little taste of it. And I'm hooked. Like, let's go. I just want to keep winning ball games. I'm sure Mr. Bachlet wants to hear that, but truly, I don't think, and I never really did as a player, I don't think too far down the road. Like, I've got Towson on my mind right now as we're talking, like, and, you know, and we'll think about the next one after that. And
you and Nad's gonna throw down the sideline. You've had some epic battles with
him. Oh yeah, I don't know if we're allowed to still headbutt each other, but I think I headbutted that guy as much or more than anyone in my career. And mad respect for that guy. He's a warrior, and, you know, he's gonna have those guys playing tough. And, you know, we're fired up. Like, this game is great. You get to meet people on the field, off the field, and you run into them. And, you know, I just can't wait to battle, and I'm looking forward to tomorrow's practice. You know, the day before a game is a great practice. It's more about the guys, the kind of haze in the barn, so to speak. And I can't wait for Friday night under the lights. You know, it's a kind of a home game for me. It's closer than Hopkins Towson is. So
we always talked about in Hobart, like, coaching staff fights, just the most hypothetical, dumb situation of all time, but
we would be fine.
You would be fine. But, like, I'm thinking about Towson. Like, you got Nads, you got Grossi, who's a complete, like, he eats iron. And then you got, oh my God.
Hop's got Kesterer. I'm not too worried about it.
Yeah. Kesterer.
Jameson will be just.
I've played pro indoor against Jameson. He is the most humble human being I've ever met. And even bringing that up, or his Crooked Arrows movie, which drives him absolutely nuts. I'm glad I threw that out there. Like, if you bring it up, he goes crazy, but he will not talk about it. And I try to get the guys to hear me. And because Jameis and I, same, we crashed and banged. And I mean, his job was to stop me from scoring. And I made him pay for it, just like he made me pay for it. But yeah, he is a massive human being.
Yeah.
He's great. And then last question we have for you. We do want to cater to the high school players out there, the guys in the recruiting process. We've seen that in the 2023 class, our current juniors that are heading into their spring seasons, that you guys have a decent amount of players committed, but just want to get a feel or a message out there for that age group, the grade below the 24s, kind of what your timeline looks like. Are you recruiting actively in the spring, or are you waiting till the summertime, still looking to pick up a few players, and what are you looking at for the 24 class?
Yeah, I mean, we don't actively recruit during the season, but because we focus on the guys we have. And sometimes the fall is a little tough because you're like spending so much time recruiting. You're like, it's like raising one child and forgetting the other one. It's like, oh, hey, I'm still here. I'm like, oh yeah, do you want to take this kid to lunch because he's coming to town? It's the strangest things. You're like, you know, Bach, like, you're basically recruiting kids to take the jobs of the kids you're coaching, and you want them to help us do it.
Yeah.
But yeah, we obviously keep our class small and hope, you know, for someone to change their mind and recognize we're the right place. But we're focused on winning games right now, and we'll get to the recruiting part when we do. But I mean, to say what we're looking for, you know, my motto is, if you're out there in games getting your teammates recruited, we'll find you. That's the way I look at it. Showcases, high school, whatever it is. If you're the guy that's getting your teammates recruited, we'll find you.
That's a great perspective.
That's a great motto for the young high school kids to take on. I mean, we could probably dissect that, Baco, in our other segment. But, Junior, this was awesome. And I know we haven't spent a ton of time talking, but a ton of clarity, a lot of interesting things that you guys are doing at Hopkins. And like I said multiple times in this interview, I'm a big fan of yours and Coach Millman's, and can't wait to see you guys kind of go to battle in the Big Ten and evolve throughout the course of the season, because I've been there from a timeline standpoint, like year one, year two, and it just, like, expectations really are meaningless. And I know you guys are going to push that group forward. So best of luck this season. And again, look forward to seeing the progress.
Thanks. Sorry if I was a little long winded there.
Great. Absolutely. Great.
No, it was awesome.
I look forward to shooting you texts after every game with my notes, but, thanks for coming on.
Appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.